weekend. It's NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up today, I'll talk to Republican State Senator Karen Housley about her campaign for the U.S. Senate and with some tribal leaders hoping to have an impact on this year's federal farm bill. But first, the Republican field for governor is down a candidate after State Representative Matt Dean announced yesterday he's ending his campaign. The news was something of a surprise because he led a straw poll of party insiders back in December. Precinct caucuses are coming up in less than 2 weeks, and that will be the first chance for rank-and-file Republicans to weigh in on who they think the Republican nominee should be in November. Matt Dean joins me on the phone now. Representative, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me on today.
So what happened? Why did you decide to drop out?
Well, we kicked off our campaign in July in St. Paul at my dad's old bar on Wright Street, and we kind of kicked off what would be considered a campaign in the Minnesota tradition, which is to go out and listen to the people. I went to the state fair every day for a dozen days, and then the day after the state fair, I headed out and traveled to all 87 counties in 87 days, and the reception was very good, and I had very good grassroots support all across the state and building that up. And also realize that as we brought our grassroots team together, that you need to be able to scale up to take that to a wider audience, beginning with caucuses and through the general election. And although I think I was the right candidate with the right message for the Republicans this year, was just not able to scale up our campaign to get to that next level. And I thought, well, if I can't do that, I want to make sure that we do so that we bring about the right changes in 2019 for Minnesota. So that's why it was a difficult decision for myself and for my family and supporters, but I think it's the right one to make sure that Minnesota heads in the right direction from our standpoint, from
bringing about some very, very needed change.
Representative, your phone is kind of coming in and out a little bit. So if you can put your mouth right up next to the phone, that'd be good for us.
All right. So, sorry about that.
No problem.
We have a good connection.
Yeah, it's always the phone these days. So does that mean you are having trouble raising money?
Well, part of it is funds, and part of it is just having the mechanisms and the means to get the message out. And so part of it is resources, and part of it is support from other folks. And you have grassroots support, but then you also need to have a broader way to get your message out and those coalitions that are very, very necessary. And as a campaigner, I understand that you need to have those coalitions, not just to get endorsed, but also to win an election from broader support outside. So having that mechanism and the ways to get the message out is important. Money is a part of that, but also you can't have people on the sidelines, and you can't have people waiting for other candidates or are waiting around or looking at their watch. It's kind of go time, and so that's another reason I think it's important for as a party to come together. Jeff Johnson is in this campaign. He's run before. And that's why I thought it was important to throw my support to somebody who's in the race, who also has a broader network to work from. And hopefully we can energize and get people motivated to really get in this game.
Well, you kind of brought up the elephant in the room there, or the elephant who's not quite in the room. And that is, there's all this talk out there that former Governor Tim Pawlenty is going to run again. Do you think that's true, and did that factor into your decision?
Well, I think it was a factor in that, we really do need to scale up, and that may have been a factor in the ability or lack thereof of my campaign to get the resources and the coalitions together to scale up, and that may have played a factor. But I don't know what his plans are, but obviously he's won statewide twice and once in 2006 and was the last person to win statewide. So there's a lot of interest around that. But I also understand that as a campaigner and as a candidate with a campaign in the race,
that is very, very important to get out there and to hear people where they are. And so to get in your car and to go to Traverse County and to go to Pennington County and to listen to folks right now for this year, I think that's incredibly important to have a campaign that's up and running and support that. And that's why I threw my support to Jeff.
You've been out for 3 months, 4 months. What have you been hearing about? What issues is this race going to turn on?
Well, the news, I would say, for Minnesota is good. There's so much negativity around politics and politicians and everything that you see in the newspaper and on TV and on your phone. But if you set down your phone, turn off your TV, set down the newspaper, and drive across Minnesota to greater Minnesota, we are a good state with good-hearted people who want some strong leadership. And that's a good thing. I think people are really looking for leadership in the state of Minnesota. They're less interested in partisanship, particularly this year, and they are really looking for solutions. And I think that was really part of the success of our campaign at the grassroots level, was not just with partisanship, but actually anti-partisanship. Some of the most conservative folks out there are the ones that are most interested in solutions. So that would be my advice for Jeff and for other candidates to really get out there and listen to people. The news is good. Minnesotans are optimistic. They're really, really hungry for leadership right now.
All right. Well, let's hope as they put down the media and they're driving around, at least they keep the radio on.
There you go.
All right. Matt Dean, thanks a lot for coming on today.
I appreciate it, and appreciate all the support from MPR listeners and other folks that have been out there, and for being so gracious to me, to our campaign, and particularly to my family as we've been out across. It's been a pleasure, no regrets, and really appreciate big-hearted Minnesotans who've been so generous to me.
Okay, Matt Dean dropped out of the Republican race for governor yesterday. And this is MPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Another developing campaign we're keeping an eye on this year is the race for U.S. Senate. Minnesota is in a relatively rare position of having two Senate seats on the ballot because DFLer Al Franken resigned. Governor Dayton appointed another Democrat, Tina Smith, to the seat, but voters will decide in November if she stays until 2020 or if someone else gets the job. And one person who is already running for the office is Republican State Senator Karen Housley from St. Mary's Point. And she's on the phone with me now. Karen Housley, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Why did you decide to do this? Why run for U.S. Senate?
You know, I think the people of Minnesota, like Matt said, are really, really, we're in a good place, and they're not very partisan, and they're looking for someone who they can trust, and they're tired of our politicians being on the front page of the newspaper for doing not what they were elected to do. And they want to send somebody to Washington that can get things done. And I've had a track record in the Minnesota State Senate of getting things done. And I thought, you know what? It's time for me to step up. The timing was right. And I knew it would be a lot of hard work, but I think we're going to do this. I think we can win. I think we can take this seat back.
What kind of things do you want to get done? What issues are most important to you?
You know what? It's again, and going across the state, people are just looking for jobs, more jobs, jobs in the economy, keeping more of their hard-earned dollars in their pockets. So the tax reform bill that President Trump got through Congress is really going to help out Minnesotans. And the state of Minnesota needs to do tax reform or tax to work with the federal government so they can keep more of their tax dollars in their pocket. Jobs are a big thing. We need to bring more jobs to Minnesota. The student debt, that is a big issue for a lot of our college students and graduates. It's a big issue that's facing them. So we will work with the state of Minnesota and the federal government to see what we can do to help out there. Our small businesses, they need help. The tax reform bill has helped there. And also what I've been working on in the state Senate for the last year and gotten some really big results is how do we help our elder population? We've got so many issues facing them, and they're sort of the forgotten generation, and so much attention has been paid to everything else that I really want to focus on our elder population.
How closely will you align yourself with President Trump? How do you think he's doing so far?
You know, I think his policies are really resonating with the people of the country, and especially here in Minnesota. He still has a 60% approval rate in greater Minnesota and a 51% approval rate in the suburbs. So his policies are working. His style isn't always my favorite style, but we can say that about a lot of people. So I've done the same thing in the Minnesota Senate. There's always, when I ran, are you going to be hook, line, and sinker with your party? And no, you know what? I'm an independent Republican, and I take every issue in front of me, and I do what's best for the people of my district, and I will do what's best for the people of Minnesota.
Can I run through some issues that have come up in the Senate over the past few months, such as how would you have voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act?
You know, and that's a, you know, what if or if I were there, and health care is really, really, and health insurance is very important to the people of Minnesota. But I can't say whether I would have or I wouldn't have because I wasn't there. But we had a really good system here in Minnesota, and it was working, and we needed to tweak it. But to flip it all on its head with Obamacare the way we did and MnSure back here in Minnesota, it didn't work. It didn't work. So something had to be done.
Well, what kind of things do you think need to be done to improve it? Are you in a position now where you would work to improve the law, or, you know, do we need to start over?
And that's, again, something when I get there, I can really look up because it is the question. Do we stick with the Obamacare and tweak it because it is there and there has been so much money put into it, or do we just throw it away and repeal it and start all over and again from square one? So it is something that we're really going to have to look at and take it apart and see what we do going forward.
Another issue that's in the news a lot is immigration. These people who are brought to the country illegally as children, should they have a path to citizenship? The Dreamers, they call them.
And President Trump just put something out the other day for a path to citizenship for the Dreamers that are here, and the Democrats are still rejecting it. So that's what they wanted all along. So it's that dysfunction in Washington and the partisan politics that everybody keeps playing. There is a path for the Dreamers, and I do believe that the Dreamers that are here should have that path to citizenship. But we need to know who is here, and that's the bottom line. Minnesotans just want to make sure that they're safe, and let's find out who is here, and let's make sure that we're safe. But President Trump did put that out the other day, and we're just waiting to see what the Democrats what they do because they've rejected it.
Well, yeah, it was kind of a general outline, right? I mean, so he mm-hmm. also wants, I think it's more than $20 billion to build that wall he keeps talking about on the border with Mexico. Are you in favor of building the wall?
I'm in favor of securing our borders. Again, it's we really have to know who's here in our country and make sure we're keeping the people of the United States safe. So, and I don't think it's really possible to build a 700-mile wall because the terrain of the land, it just isn't possible. But securing those borders in those bigger areas where they are crossing, I think we do need to secure it.
What about the mass shootings like the one in Las Vegas and school shootings like the one in Kentucky this week that left two kids dead? Is there anything the federal government can or should be doing about that?
Well, and that was so sad. I remember the Las Vegas shooting and then the Kentucky the other day. We always have to be looking at mental health situations and how do we solve that? Because if it's not a terrorist attack and it's a mental health issue, we really do need some resources going to help these people that do these heinous acts. So always continuing to look at to look at our mental health,
but nothing on in terms of guns or regulating any new regulations for firearms?
You know, I am not into really changing any gun laws. I don't think a person with a mental health issue is going to get the guns no matter which way they want to get them. So I think it's really at the core of the issue of both of these shootings was a mental health issue.
You know, another terrible problem facing the country is this opioid crisis. What should the federal government do to stop people from abusing these drugs and from overdosing? And it's causing, you know, terrible, terrible trouble all across the country, including here in Minnesota.
And every family here in Minnesota knows somebody or has a family member who has an opioid addiction. And it is sad. I was just talking to the guy who was snowblowing my driveway yesterday, and this was a big issue that he had. And it's running rampant throughout the country, and we really do need to look at our opioid addiction and how do we help these people and how do we stop it from happening. So it definitely needs to be looked at because it's a growing issue.
Trade issues. The president has, he campaigned on abolishing NAFTA. He said it was a terrible deal. The U.S. should abandon it. Where are you on NAFTA? Where are you on international trade?
And NAFTA here in Minnesota, you've got the farmers who have a lot of product that they need to export. And it's very important that it's friendly to them. But then yet you have the steel dumping up in northern Minnesota. So we have to – there's a fine balance. And I don't think there's always one way to do things cut and dry. So I think we really have to, especially for the people in Minnesota, to listen to both sides of NAFTA and see what's going to work best for them. And that's what I would support.
We're talking with Karen Housley right now. She is a state senator from St. Mary's Point. She's running for the U.S. Senate, hopes to be on the ballot this November, talking about some of the issues, trying to find out where she's coming from. And Senator Housley, you were first elected to the state Senate in 2012. Have you learned anything about government that surprised you or you didn't think about before you went into office?
Well, yeah, I've learned a lot. Everybody said that there was a lot of money wasted in government, but once you actually get there and you see it, it's rampant. They're in every single department, the money that is wasted and the mismanagement of funds and the antiquated systems that are being used. It keeps you awake at night. It's just grown so big, and when something grows that big. You can have whole departments do it. Look at the Department of Health and the Office of Health Facility Complaints. The whole thing completely imploded, and nobody really knew what was going on over there. And so when government gets that big, there's waste of money. And so that was something that you heard about was happening, but until you're actually in the middle of it, you just go, oh, my goodness gracious, there needs to be so many reforms over here. And I'm pretty sure it's the same at the federal government. So there's a lot of reforms and there's a lot of efficiency that can be done in both state and federal government.
How do you fix that without more money in the case where, you know, some of the complaints were being thrown in the recycling because they just couldn't deal with them? How do you fix that?
You hold people accountable. You just can't have somebody have a job and get a salary and do nothing. And that's, I think, what was happening. I know that's what was happening within the OHSC and the Department of Health and all the way on up. So you don't need to throw more money at it. You need to hold those people in management in charge of the departments they're in charge of and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do. And that hasn't been done here in the state of Minnesota. So it seems that the Democrat solution is always to throw more money at it. And we actually did give more money to the OHSC and the Department of Health, and that didn't work. So we really need to look at each and every department and peel away the onion and find out what's at the root of it and where our money is being spent efficiently and where it's not, get rid of it.
Let me ask you some political questions. This campaign is a major undertaking. How much money do you think you'll need to get it going? And what else do you need to actually get the nomination and be on the ballot in November?
Well, Mike, it's going. The campaign is going. We had good fundraising numbers by the end of the year, and I think the whole campaign, 15 to 20 million, it's going to be a lot of money, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. But that's just the way politics are, unfortunately. And I think there's a real path to victory. The endorsement process that we have here in Minnesota, the caucus system, it's good. I've been reaching out to the delegates, and our caucuses are February 6th. The endorsement convention is June 2nd, and I'm going for that endorsement. And so far, everything is going really well with that, getting great response, so I'm excited. I'm going to win this. I'm very excited.
Do you expect any serious competition for the endorsement?
I haven't seen any yet, so I don't know if, and I had the list come out of endorsements from state senators, my colleagues who know what I've done in the state Senate, and that I am a independent Republican, think for myself and do what's right. So I don't know if there'll be any serious competition, but I guess anybody that jumps in is serious competition. But again, it's just working to get the trust of the delegates and the people of Minnesota that I'm working for. So I think I haven't heard of anybody.
Let me ask you two questions. Do you know Tina Smith, and what kind of race would you expect to run against her?
I do know Tina Smith because she was the lieutenant governor. So I have been at functions with her. And I'm going to run my own race. You know, Tina can run her own race, but I'm going to run a clean. It was nice listening to Matt Dean because I thought he ran a really great race for governor. I'm sad to see him step out. But I'm going to run a clean race and be positive, because that's what the people of Minnesota want to hear. They want to know, what are you going to do for them, and do they trust you? And so I'm going to talk to them about the issues that affect them right there in their own homes and their own families. And I've never been one in any of the races that I've run to get negative or attack. There's enough other people out there that do that. I'm going to run the race on, you know, who Karen Housley is and what Karen Housley can do in the United States Senate.
Well, and, you know, I don't mean this last question to be glib, but why would anybody really want to run for Senate? People hate Washington. Congress never seems to get much done, as you said. And plus, you put yourself up for all kinds of criticism on social media and everywhere else. Mm-hmm. Why put yourself through that?
Because there is a love of helping people. And that is what I really, really enjoy doing. And you can read on Twitter and Facebook the nasty things that are said about you. But when you have the woman who drives down from Bemidji to tell you about her mom and her nursing home, who that they had to amputate her leg because she had an infection that went on and nobody noticed it. When you really can help people, the rewards far outweigh any of the negativity out there. And I know I've done great things here in the state of Minnesota, and I really want to help Minnesota and have Minnesota have a common sense voice in the United States Senate. So because I love it, Mike.
Okay. Well, Karen Housley, thanks a lot for coming on today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That's Karen Housley. She's a Republican state senator who's running for U.S. Senate this year. And I should also note that we have invited Tina Smith to come on the program, and her office is trying to work out the scheduling on that. Congress is working on another 5-year farm bill. It's one of the largest pieces of domestic legislation, covering everything from the nutrition program that used to be known as food stamps to crop supports to conservation and rural development. This year, Native people, who have at times in the past been largely left out of the debate, are making a new effort to be sure that their voices are heard. The Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community, which owns the Mystic Lake Casino, is hoping to be a key player in the effort. It's joining with other tribes across the U.S. to exert financial and political clout to protect and advance their interests in the Farm Bill. We're going to talk about that effort, and two guests join me on the phone. Zach Ducheneau is secretary of the Intertribal Agricultural Council. That's a group that was formed in 1987 to promote agricultural resources for the betterment of Indian people. Also on the line is Keith Anderson, vice chair of the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community. Thanks, gentlemen, for being with me today. And Zach Ducheneau, if I can ask you, why is the Farm Bill so important for Native people?
Thanks for having us. The first and foremost, I think we got to consider the fact that the Farm Bill reaches way beyond the borders and fences of the $3.4 billion American Indian ag economy. There isn't a single aspect of a local community, rural community, that isn't impacted by the Farm Bill. There's everything from the food and nutrition programs that you mentioned, to financing for the capital and the infrastructure to develop food products, to rural development programs for housing and community facilities. We sat and we really tried to examine, is there anything that we can find in our community that couldn't be impacted through thoughtful Farm Bill activities? And about the only thing that we came up with was law enforcement and judicial activities, but we can build the buildings for those things with Farm Bill programs.
Interesting. So it really is a vital piece of legislation to the people you represent.
Absolutely. And to the American people writ large, it's the largest non-defense spending authorization that the American people are ever going to see to this point.
Mm-hmm. Keith Anderson, why did the Shakopee Mdewakanton community decide to get involved?
Well, good morning, Mike. And then, hi, Zach. How are you doing? Zach and I have been working with the coalition. The Farm Bill is important to us in Indian country because of those programs that Zach is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We all get food access in some way or another. Part of being a tribal entity and exercising our sovereignty would be to have food sovereignty.
Talk a little more about that. What do you mean by food sovereignty, and what does that look like?
Well, we all need food to survive, and I need food access is key in that part. You know, 7 out of 10 tribes across the country are very rural, which makes food access that we enjoy in the metro area here, it looks different out there. It's not as easy to access. Farming is a way that you can produce that food. And when you have food that's quality and of the amounts that you need, that puts you in that position of being able to feed yourself. Very simple concept, but the ability to feed ourselves has long been it's been a cornerstone of our culture ever since the beginning.
And I know that there are a lot of health concerns among American Indians, diabetes, other diet-related problems. I assume that played a big role in this effort as well.
Yes, it has. As a matter of fact, it gave us the recognition that we needed to add to our philanthropic endeavors a way to improve our health, our preventative health. The way to do that is get in front of it with access to nutritional food, how to grow that nutritional food and get that food prepared. So we're doing education on accessing the farm. What do they say, from the farm to the table?
Mm-hmm.
You can grow the nutritional food that you need, learn how to prepare it correctly, and avoid the things that have caused, well, diabetes and obesity, and that's a big problem in Native America.
Mm-hmm. And so, Zach, what do you want out of the Farm Bill to help get to that food sovereignty? Is that the main thing you're looking for, and what does it look like?
Well, I think we'd like to take advantage of this opportunity to reframe the entire discussion around healthy food and Native food and tribal food. To us, you cannot have healthy food if the ingredients that go into making it are being extracted at an economic loss to a community. And what we have in Indian country right now, the $3.4 billion worth of ag products that are grown, 99.99% of that isn't food. It's things that are going to be turned into food later on. And that's the essence of food sovereignty, is to change that paradigm and change that discussion so that we're adding value to those products in our communities in addressing the socioeconomic determinants that really are the underlying cause of things like diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. Those are not necessarily strictly nutritional in nature. There's a lot of other things that go into that, and it's all from that foundation of poverty that they spring forward.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope to be able to engage the discussion in a manner that sheds light on the circumstances in Indian country that prevents us from developing our food ingredients into food products in a holistic, sustainable way. Right now, for example, on Cheyenne River, we've got about 45,000 head of Native American-owned livestock. And the meat that is sold in our tribal grocery store travels about 1,800 miles to get here.
Hmm.
So the circle is broken, and we need the infrastructure in place to be able to start to develop these things into food here so that we can recoup more of the food dollar in Indian country.
I hadn't even thought about cattle, but you, when you said that the things that you're producing on your farms are not food, I was thinking corn and soybeans, which it seems like that's what the farm bill generally supports.
Yes, that's true. For the last few iterations of the farm bill, we've worked to try to bring some parity to the livestock producers. Of that $3.4 billion in ag products grown in Indian country, just over half of it is livestock, and a vast majority of that is beef cattle.
Mm-hmm. But it's not being consumed where it's being produced.
That's true.
Keith Anderson, when I first heard about this in a story on NPR by our reporter Dan Gunderson, you made it clear that your community is able to do this and to help organize this effort because you have clout and money, and that gives you a seat at the table. Tell us about that. How has that made a difference from the way this process has worked in the past?
Well, I'm pretty sure I didn't say money, but you're correct.
Well, doesn't clout come with money?
Clout can come with money, but at the same time, showing up is very effective as well. You know, we've always been prevalent in Washington, but I don't think we've always been as successful as we are today at doing it. That doesn't mean we haven't been successful there. I hope to someday be as successful as my predecessors. But I think we understand things better, and you have access to the resources that we do. And, you know, we're very, very fortunate. We're the exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to utilize those resources responsibly with a very large philanthropic donation package every year. And we also have engaged in in 2015, we put $10 million into a campaign called, we call it the Seeds of Native Health, which is looking at a lot of these nutrition. We're trying to study it and put codes to the food seed and get education and awareness out on these problems. But it takes partnerships. And those are the types of resources that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of clout in Washington, when you're able to show up and communicate face-to-face with legislatures, I think it's that kind of communication that enlightens people on the effect that the Farm Bill has on tribes. It is being accessed in ways that I think aren't part of the agenda that it gets presented when they talk about it, debate various parts of the Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get that message effectively across, we need to go there. And when we go there, we're able to go there a lot easier than, say, Zach out in rural South Dakota. You know, if there's weather, he can't get here to fly there. It just might not be in the budget for a lot of tribes, so they have to maximize their trips. And what we try to do is carry that message every time that we can. If there's something that we can talk about that's common to tribes across the country, we carry that message very heavily.
And how are other Indian communities responding? Are they welcoming your help, or is there some resentment?
We don't definitely do not go there and speak for anyone. There are right now 50 tribes in the coalition. the Farm Bill Coalition that we partnered with Ross Racine and of course Zach, and those 50 tribes have come and wanted to join this message carrying. So we are asking for that, and we're also asking for what's missing in the, so far in what we've identified as, and we have a pretty healthy size report on regaining our future with a risk and opportunity for Native communities in the Farm Bill. I got two emails prior to going to Washington the last time I went to speak to Senator Udall in a hearing committee that discussed the Farm Bill and how it impacts tribes. And that's neat for them to be able to talk to me and say, if you could mention this is what's happening in our area. Mm-hmm. You have fish, timber, wild rice. I mean, it covers so many topics. And as you said in the beginning, you know, the Farm Bill is about nutrition programs and agriculture production, rural development, natural resource conservation. We do a lot of that here. But as Zach said, the majority of it comes from that, for that nutrition program, a lot of it being the access to food where it's not easily accessible.
Mm-hmm. We've heard from Congressman Colin Peterson and some others in Washington that they're not expecting a lot of new money in the bill compared to last time. Are you how worried are you that once again your concerns will fall to the back of the pack just because, you know, the money's so tight?
Well, we get very concerned. Money is tight, but there are scenarios that I don't think are being considered, and I think that's what you're talking about. The most common, I think, misunderstanding of food stamps, you get to hear the negative impacts or the negative uses of people who access food stamps, but that's a very important program to, you know, not only low income, but, you know, there are a good deal of veteran, non-native people that need any type of cut in that area because of a political value or just maybe a legislature that maybe gets steered towards the negative aspect of it are really impacting a lot of lives. One in four Native Americans, they need this nutritional assistance.
Hmm. Well, Zach Duchesneau, let me ask you about that. You mentioned poverty before, and how have the historical factors of racism and poverty played into tribes being left out when it comes to some of this spending?
Well, I think it's just been an overthought, or an oversight on the part of the prevailing economy or prevailing society, however you want to qualify it. The fact that there's the discussion that's leading into no new money, it kind of perpetuates that. So one of the things that we're really proud of is our ability to find solutions within existing parameters. And there are many ways that we can do that without creating a new program with new money. It's about improving accessibility for our Native American and tribal producers to the programs that are already there and finding a way to streamline and chip away at the regulations that are keeping us from participating on an institutional basis. You know, Chairman Anderson mentioned the capacity that Shakopee Mattawakutan brings to the table. We've got another tribe that brings that similar kind of capacity to the table in the Quapaw Nation in Oklahoma. And they testified at the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing last year that we were party to about their success and how their success was tied to the ability to access casino revenue to diversify their portfolio into agriculture. So what we've got to do in this Farm Bill is find ways to funnel, if you will, that capital resource that doesn't exist in the credit deserts that are Indian country through improved access to farm loan programs, through improved access and better terms through rural development, because commercial credit the way our non-Indian counterparts understand it just across that imaginary line where the reservation boundary ends does not exist in Indian country, where our non-Indian counterparts may be looking for a loan to buy a farm truck. They're going to pay 5-6%. We're paying 12-17% for that same vehicle loan with the same Federal Reserve allocated funding through that bank.
So it's really some systemic problems you're trying to address here.
Absolutely. And that's you know, and we've got a whole list of different ideas how we can just improve the access and get a little better attention on what we need to fit within existing programs. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to stop advocating for new and innovative approaches with new funding simply because we're being told there's no funding available. We've got to continue to make sure that the needs of Indian country are being raised, even if they're being ignored or told that the timing's not right.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. It's absolutely fascinating discussion, and we'll try to keep an eye on it and see what happens.
Absolutely, Mike. Thank you for having us, and it's good to hear from you again, as always, Zach. And anything we can do to help, don't hesitate to call.
Thank you. And thank you, Mike, and thank you, Keith. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot. That's Zach Ducheneau. He's the Secretary of the Intertribal Agriculture Council. And Keith Anderson joined us as well. He's Vice Chair of the Shakopee Medwakaton Sioux Community. And to wrap things up on this Friday program, we're going to check in with our state capitol reporters, Brian Baxt and Tim Pugmire, for a quick word about some of the events of the week. Brian, I'm going to start with you. This morning, the state released some information about sexual harassment allegations inside state agencies. What were you able to learn?
Yeah, this is the first real snapshot we've had of what's been going on in state agencies. They've released about 5 years worth of data about complaints and settlements across state government. And the state has paid out about $700,000 in settlements just since 2015 involving sexual harassment complaints. A lot of these settlements involve the standard no admission of liability or wrongdoing wording, but they are an indication that this is an issue. There's about 250 or 266 cases actually since 2012 that have been investigated, and a little more than half of those have been substantiated. There's still about 12 that are still pending. And in response to this and another review of just the policies in general, the state agencies are recommending to the governor, and the governor says he will recommend to the legislature that a central office be created so there's more independence in investigating complaints and transparency and comfort for the victims.
And this all came up after the allegations late last year that led two state legislators to resign. Are the House and Senate going to do anything different?
Yes, and in fact, just a few minutes ago, Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka released some information to say that he's ordered a full-scale review of the Senate's policies, and he hopes to develop a policy sometime in this year that will include a mechanism for third-party people to lodge complaints. Those are like lobbyists, visitors, people who just haven't had an avenue before. And all lawmakers are going to be undergoing additional sexual harassment training beyond what's normally required, which is typically been about every 5 years or just when they're elected.
Interesting. And we'll have more later in the day. Tim Pugmire.
And an interesting thing about the Gazelka announcement is it mentions that the people that don't, the senators and staff who do not complete this mandatory training by March 2nd will be publicly reported to the Rules Committee. And so we'll see if anyone actually doesn't follow through on that requirement.
Let me change the subject a little because we're short on time and it's going to be a lightning round today. I talked to Matt Dean earlier in the hour after he dropped out of the governor's race yesterday. Was that as big a surprise as it seemed? And everybody's talking about Tim Pawlenty. Do we know what he's going to do? Tim, let me start with you.
Well, I was surprised, and many people I've talked to were surprised that Matt Dean left the race. I mean, it seemed as though he was doing well and, you know, had won that straw poll a couple of months ago. Seemed like he was picking up support, doing well with the delegates. He was traveling around the state, so it was a big surprise.
And, Brian, what about Tim Pawlenty?
Well, yeah, he continues to cast a shadow over this race that he's not even in yet, if he gets in at all. Some of the donors have been on the sidelines, and some other people who would normally kind of be the support network for these candidates are waiting to see what happens. We'll get the first sense as to how divided the party is or how united the party is on precinct caucus night on February 6th, and we'll get the first look at those finance numbers next week when these reports are due through the end of 2017 fundraising.
And Tim, you were at a forum this morning where basically all the major candidates, Democrats and Republicans, were talking. Anything interesting come out of that?
Well, it was an interesting format. Rather than all nine of these candidates crowded on a stage, they were brought up one at a time and interviewed. Basically, the same set of questions for each candidate. This was co-sponsored by the Center for Rural Policy and Development, so many of the questions were on rural issues such as, you know, workforce shortages, affordable housing, immigration, education needs, things of that nature.
Brian, do you get the sense that regular Minnesotans are paying much attention to this yet, or is this still sort of an insider game trying to talk to people who are going to show up for those precinct caucuses?
Yeah, the universe is still pretty narrow as far as these campaigns go. You know, we're not to the point where people are going to be airing ads or mailing broadly. And keep in mind, we're still in the President Trump era where he's got a lot of the oxygen, the political oxygen right now. So the governor's candidates are going to have to do a lot more this year to break through.
Well, there was a story that on the Republican side, some allegations of dirty tricks. Jeff Johnson was saying that some of Keith Downey's staffer had put up sort of an erroneous post on Facebook, right?
Well, yeah, there was a back and forth over this, and apparently the two sides have talked it over, and it's unclear as to exactly how things went down. But this is another one of those inside party fights.
Tim, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
I was just going to say it was primarily a Facebook dispute. That's that's where this all took place. We heard yesterday Commissioner Jeff Johnson didn't even want to address it in his news conference with Matt Dean.
There was a report in Politico this morning that said Keith Ellison might be interested in a run for Minnesota Attorney General, and that he's bored with his job in Congress. Brian, do you know anything about that?
It was news to me. I've spoken with some people who are close to Keith Ellison, and they say that this was stuff that he was kicking around a while ago and has come since to the conclusion that he's going to run again for his seat in Congress, or at least that's the plan at this point. Keith Ellison was mentioned as a potential U.S. Senate candidate for that Al Franken seat, but he deferred to Tina Smith. So people are wondering what he's going to do, if he's going to change course. It doesn't look very likely at this point.
Okay, there are some primaries coming up on Monday in some special legislative elections. Tim Pugmire, give us a quick overview.
Right. These are the two special elections that are filling these seats vacated by State Senator Dan Schoen and State Representative Tony Cornish, who resigned amid separate allegations over sexual misconduct. Republicans have special primaries in both of those contests on Monday in Senate District 54. Denny McNamara and James Brunsgaard are squaring off in the Republican special primary. DFLer Carla Bigham and a Libertarian candidate await them on February 12th. In House District 23B, Republican Jeremy Munson and Scott Sanders are the Republican candidates in the special primary. Munson is the endorsed candidate, but Cornish has come out and publicly supported Sanders.
And just with a few seconds left here, the Senate race is interesting because it could play into this whole dispute over who's going to control the state Senate.
Yeah, that's right. This is needed by the DFL to win, to hang on to that narrow 34-32 a margin, or 34 to 33 margin that we saw last session. They're hoping to advance that if the court rules against Michelle Fischbach in her effort to hold the lieutenant governor job and her Senate seat.
Well, we covered a lot of ground there. I hope we didn't leave anybody behind. That's Tim Pugmire. Brian Bax, too, joined us, our political reporters. Thanks a lot, and that's our Friday program.